Welcome to True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to The High Treason Club, an exploration of the Bodumach treason trial and an interview with the author of the book The High Treason Club, Karen Mitchell, and the now retired SAPS detective who cracked the case, Colonel Tolly Vlechtenberg. Make upgrading your home security a priority with Ring's range of smart security devices, indoor and outdoor cameras, video doorbells and alarms. Ring products are easy to install and allow you to monitor your home from your phone or tablet via the Ring app, no matter where you are. With cameras in strategic locations, indoors and outdoors, you can create a ring of security around your property. Ring security devices boast advanced features, including live view, two-way talk, motion-activated alerts, and night vision. Available at Takealot, Incredible Connection, Hersh's, and other major retailers. It's just after midnight on the 29th of October, 2002. A family of four sleep soundly in their home in Protea South informal settlement in Soweto. Earlier that night, they'd eaten supper together. The father, Chinyadzo Mkwati, his wife, Claudia Mokone, and their children, respectively 16 and 8 years old, had happily chatted about their day while they ate. It was a very normal weekday evening. As they'd settled in for the night, they could have no idea that it would be the last night of their lives that would be anything close to normal for them. As the clock struck midnight, a loud explosion resonated through the air. The timing of that explosion and its effects on Claudia and her family were almost simultaneous. The family's home was just 400 metres from the new Canada railway line. And when that line was bombed that night, the steel from the track turned into a deadly flying weapon. The piece of steel came through the roof of the family's home, striking the bed in which Chinyadzo and Claudia slept. Claudia Mokone was killed instantly. She sustained a life-ending head injury. Chinyadzo awoke with a vague realization that something had happened, but didn't immediately know that his wife was dead. He also didn't fully comprehend how badly he was injured. In all, he would spend a week recuperating in hospital after surgery. His jaw had been broken and his shoulder badly injured. He carries the scars of that night, both on his body and in his heart. Thankfully, the children were uninjured, at least physically. As Claudia's husband had been rushed to the hospital and her children had been ushered off sobbing and in shock to the neighbours, three men had been making their escape. Dion Kraus and brothers Corbus and Johan Pretorius would only discover the ultimate outcome of their deed later. But the news of Claudia's death would not have saddened them. On the contrary, death and destruction had been the very purpose of what they'd done that night. In fact, they'd intended to kill far more than one person. Four bombs had been planted in and around Soweto that day in 2002. Through various strokes of luck and poor planning on the bombers' part, most had not detonated with their full force. If they had, what is now known as the 2002 Soweto bombings would have become, in the opinion of the man who would eventually help to arrest the bombers, the beginning of South Africa's own 9/11. Only with far more casualties. the story of how those three men and the others who'd been in the area that night had come to be there, carrying out their hateful plan, is one which I don't think many South Africans really know all that well. And let me tell you, it will send cold shivers down your spine when you think of the horrific consequences that could well have come to pass had their plan worked. Because this incident was only the tip of the iceberg, and those men were just part of a much larger group. Similar acts of terror had been planned across the country. The eventual goal was for them to overthrow the government. From shooting down passenger aeroplanes as they took off from Cape Town International and passed over Khayelitsha, to the assassination of then-President Nelson Mandela. The plans of the group who would eventually be named as the Burumakh were undoubtedly hate crimes, targeting specifically black people, but in general, all people of colour. As a collective, though, their crimes amounted to one of the most serious crimes a South African citizen can face: high treason. Within months of these incidents, through incredible police work by a team of SAPS investigators, including Colonel Tolly Vlechtenberg, many of the suspects were arrested. The personal and professional cost of this case had been immense for Tolly, and the arrests were just the beginning of a process that would span another decade. He would spend a lot of time in court, and one of the most dedicated journalists on the case became a familiar face. 23 years after the murder of Claudia Mokone, journalist Karen Mitchell has published what I can only call an epic account of the group, its members, its plans, and its eventual downfall. The High Treason Club is, in my opinion, one of the best true crime books published in a very long time. And yes, I'll acknowledge it's not your average true crime fare, but it is utterly compelling reading. Karen has taken what could be a long list of relatively difficult-to-digest information and turned it into an incredibly well-told story of hatred, skewed religion, culture, indoctrination, and what happens when a very specific group of individuals all believe they're doing the world a favour, when in fact, that could not be further from the truth. I had the huge pleasure of chatting with Karen Mitchell and Tolly Vlechtenberg about the book and the case. And today, you'll hear their first-person accounts of what it was like covering one of the longest trials in South African history and solving, undoubtedly, one of the most important cases to the stability of South Africa and its future. So let's meet Karen and Tolly.
Hi, I'm Karen Mitchell. I am a journalist and now author. So how I got involved with the Burumakh, this dates back to 2011, so about 14 years ago. I was a fresh intern at a radio station. I was 2 months into my internship and I was doing the advisories for the Monday morning. And the Burumakh trial was resuming for its 8th year. And so I was sent to the case to go and basically get a grasp on court reporting, and very much spent months to years in the courtroom. And that is how the Burumakh journey started for me, but it certainly didn't end there.
I'm a retired colonel from the DPCI. I retired after 43 years of service in the police. The Burumakh case choose me. I didn't choose it. In 2002, I stumbled upon it by accident and got involved in it. And by 2013, we finalized the case after 10 years in court. So that's in very short version of a very long case. But in the book, there is a description of how I stumbled upon it and how I took the case and became the chief investigating officer in the case. There's a big chapter about it, a huge chapter about it. But I would like the reader to read and then think about it, how something just crosses your road and you must seize the opportunity once it's there.
43 years in the police. I just turned 45. That is a literal lifetime. And Karen has been just as dedicated to her craft over the years. As I mentioned, this trial was one of the longest running in South African history. And if you pay any attention to the average length of trials in our country, you'll know that this is no mean feat. And in the book, Karen mentions that she was one of the few journalists that ended up attending almost every single appearance. I wondered whether that was because she was just that interested in it, or if she was under instruction.
It was most certainly not a choice. So this was 8 years into the trial. And if you think about the resources that newsrooms have, it's absolutely impossible to deploy a journalist to a trial for 8 years straight. And by that time, the Boeremag had become almost forgotten. So there wasn't really new updates. And that's why my editor thought, you know what, let's send you in there. This case has had so many applications. There are so many accused. It's a great place for you to just understand how courts work to start with. So I was literally sent there every single day. And yeah, it was because I was the intern. I was the newbie there. And I didn't have the skills to cover other stories yet. And I'm not ashamed to say that. This was definitely a learning ground for me.
I feel like that's kind of perfect, though. The case that intern Karen used to cut her teeth probably became one of the most pivotal she'd cover in her career, at least so far. And it was actually incredibly important that someone be covering this. And Tolly says he remembers how the big career journalists were all gung-ho at first, but didn't seem to have the staying power for a decade of high treason.
From my side, when he started the trial in 2003, the courtroom was flooded with journalists in such a way that I had to call Sally De Beer, the police spokesperson, to assist me in court in handling the press day. Gradually, the media lost interest in the case. And the biggest thing that happened to us is when we moved across to the new court, the new High Court building, the advocate Barbie case started in the courtroom next to us. And all the media found that much more interesting than our boring terrorist case. And luckily, with a smile on my face, I say they left me alone in my court.
I think that it's cases like this that highlight the importance of journalism. As much as we can sometimes have negative things to say about the media in general, if it weren't for them, we wouldn't know about the vast majority of events that happen on a daily basis. I clearly remember hearing about this case when it happened. But then, as the headlines waned, I forgot about it until this book came out. And I think that's probably true for many South Africans. So I'm really thankful that there was at least one journalist who stuck it out and ended up writing a book about it. And as I got deeper into the book, as someone who's written a few myself, I realized what an enormous undertaking this had to have been. The amount of information around this case is just massive, and I couldn't fathom how hard it must have been to put this all into a coherent, but then also readable account for a book. There's also this really clever technique Karen uses, where she jumps between timelines, bringing readers to a more recent point, and then thrusting them back in time to when these events all took place, which I found fascinating and really made so much sense.
I'm very relieved to hear all of that. Thank you very much, Nicole. So in 2016, I decided that I wanted to write the book. And coming from a radio background, I mean, you can talk to any radio reporter and we will tell you that you need to be able to tell a story in three sentences. You need to give the update, the background, and what this means. And that is literally what I did with the book. I wrote the front or the first page and I said, okay, that's the story. And then I realized just how tough this was going to be. And that's when I started going through all of the court archives, which spans more than 60,000 pages, and very quickly realized that it would be impossible to go through every single person's testimony to work out this story. So what I did is I identified all of the state's key witnesses. I identified the 204 application witnesses and also the main players during the trial. So you had several leader figures and then just the characters essentially that attached to these main characters. And the big thing for me was I sat in court for months and years on end, and it was boring. Like, it's very boring sitting in a courtroom and hearing these things just dragging on. And I realized I needed to tell this in a way that was not boring. And that is why I always wanted the characters to kind of tell the story to the reader, because it's a show, don't tell kind of thing. I just really wanted to rely on the action and the severity of it, but also to jump through the timelines to kind of get your reader invested in different aspects of this case, because it was very much multi-layered.
As you'll read in the book, the title, The High Treason Club, comes from a few of the accused, who, after they were convicted in court, slapped each other's backs and smiled, saying, "Welcome to the High Treason Club." You know, like it's an achievement. I've never covered a case involving the charge of high treason, and I couldn't offhand think of any other cases having involved this charge. So I asked Tolly, who would know far better than me, how common this charge is, and what do you actually have to do to be charged with it?
In the history of South Africa's political background, if you look at all the ANC, PAC accused that has been charged in the past since the 60s, there was always the main charge was high treason. And then secondary and alternatively, there was another old 1954 Terrorism Act, various other charges. So the same was applicable here. The first charge, charge number one was count number one on the indictment was high treason. And then from count two to count 44 was all different charges under the old Terrorism Act. But it was alternative. That's hence why the judge convicted all of them on high treason for the conspiracy part. Now, the requirements for high treason is that you must be, firstly, a citizen of South Africa or have an alliance to the South African government. Secondly, you have to plan or conspire to overthrow the current government of the country. If you go back into the history, Nelson Mandela was never charged on high treason. He was charged on terrorism charges. And the judge in his judgment said if he was charged on high treason, he would have convicted him of high treason and sentenced him to capital punishment. So he would have been executed. Many other ANC cadres were charged for high treason and they were executed as their sentence.
The Burumakh group to which all of the accused and convicted belonged were both fascinating in structure, in my opinion, and quite terrifying. I feel like these groups are far more common than we think they may be. And they almost felt cult-like in some ways to me.
So the right-wing extremists in South Africa do exist. It will never go away. It's fueled by the current government's lack of proper governance. And it will never go away. There will always be a strife for freedom, independence from the right-wing, extremist right-wing in South Africa. And with extremism, that is the key word. There is, I will not say the word normal, there is the average person in South Africa with a white skin that lives here and have no problem with what is going on in the country, or does speak out about it. But then there is the group that has two factors that is influencing them. The first one is the religion, the Israel vision, and secondly is the prophecies of Sina van Rensburg that plays a major role in making them and classifying them extremists, and where they get the justification to commit acts of terrorism or acts of violence with the purpose to secure their own piece of land in South Africa, their own Boerestaat in South Africa. They are there. They will always be there. When I'm dead and maybe my grandchildren are still alive, maybe that will be because that's a generational thing that will work out, will have to work out.
I think that's a really good explanation because it is exactly within that word, extremism, that all the harm lies. Unfortunately, that's difficult for many people to differentiate between when they hear that terrorists or other people who commit criminal acts in the name of some cause were attached to a specific group or religion. As Tolle says, it's not the religion, or the political school of thought for that matter, that is truly harmful. It's when people think that they're entitled to commit violence in order to promote that school of thought that things get really dangerous. I've been thinking about this a lot lately, and how in South Africa we might be in a really precarious spot, given what's happening in other countries, where a lot of people might be very vulnerable to extremist indoctrination. This book came out just after US President Donald Trump had started making some poorly informed blanket statements about our country, and I couldn't help but think how that would be like fuel to the fire of someone who may already be feeling that there's a specific perceived threat against them. I asked Karen what she thought about the book being published into the public discourse that was happening at the time.
Absolutely. So I believe that was it early February or early March when Trump issued that executive order? And it was about a month or two before the release of the book. And I remember I just went cold. So I definitely did not plan it. It was definitely not planned on my side, because also if you're launching a book, you are obviously stressed about the climate in which it's going to be released and how people are going to, what the acceptance is going to be of the book. But it's also heading back to the refugee status. And with you mentioning the perceived threats, I obviously sat and thought about this quite a bit. For me, we don't have a genocide in the country. I think a lot of people will agree on that. Right. But also, it's not for me to say that your fears are not warranted. So we need to be able to step away. And also, that was one of my big lessons in covering the Boeremacht trial, is we need to be able to step away from our own beliefs and our own ideologies and put ourselves into other people's shoes. If somebody, let's say, like the Boeremacht, if you lived on a farm all of your life and people are telling you that there's this threat, your people are going to be killed, there's going to be mass black on white violence, obviously some of that will ring true to you and it will instill some fear in you. So from that perspective, I understand. And that is what the book has taught me, or the trial has taught me, is to just be more understanding of people and why people act in certain ways. But also we need to remember, just heading back to the Boeremacht, that what they did was absolutely not right. So you need to always remember what the actions are. And if anything is illegal, that is what it is. It's illegal. That's the long and the short of it.
Fear is a powerful driver, and that is really, at the base of it, what I feel was weaponized in this case, and is so often weaponized in similar situations. And it's another reason I become so concerned when skewed narratives start being repeated, which may end up feeding into the fears that some people have. One of the reasons that I think this book is such an important read for every South African is because we need to realize how close we came to having a completely different future in this country. In the book, Karen describes how several of the Boeremacht group members had set up an assassination attempt to kill Nelson Mandela, and they came terrifyingly close. Essentially, what they were trying to do was trigger a civil race war, which they believed was foretold in the visions of a man called Sina van Rensburg. We'll discuss him a bit more later. I actually got goosebumps when I read the passage about that assassination attempt and how close we came to a completely different outcome. I asked Tolly if he ever thinks about how deeply this case and his investigation actually changed the entire country's future.
Nicole, while I was busy with the case, I was concentrating on the facts in front of me, reflecting back to it after retirement and assisting Karen in finalizing the book. I really thought about it and I realized that, yes, if that happened, if Mandela was killed, and I always say it on our launches, South Africa would have looked like Gaza today. We would have had a major genocide, racial war in South Africa that nobody would have been able to stop. As you said, the country as we see today would have been a complete different place. But also that is the one day that's important. What is also important is the last planned attack, the attack on the 13th of December 2002, when they wanted to explode four car bombs consisting of 300 kilograms of ammonium nitrate at huge taxi ranks in Gauteng. Now, we worked out as today, by chance, I don't know when this is going to end, but by chance today is 9/11, 3 o'clock this afternoon, South African time, that the planes hit the buildings. Now, the 13th of December 2002 would have been South Africa's 9/11 times 4. We estimated that any one of those scenes, if the bomb, 300 kilogram bomb exploded, it would be at least 3,000 casualties at each one of those four scenes where the bombs were supposed to plant, to detonate it. Luckily, by the grace of God, we arrested them on the 10th, 11th, and 12th of December, 2 days, a day before the planned attack.
There are two scenes in the book that made me wonder how much responsibility Tolly must have felt on his shoulders in those moments. One was when he pulled out what the Burumakh called blue papers from a briefcase found as evidence. Those blue papers detailed the plans that the group had to overthrow the government. And the other moment was when he realized that somewhere out there was a truck full of explosives. And if he didn't catch these guys in time, many innocent people may die. I asked him what those moments were like.
At that stage, one must put your personal feelings aside and you must get professional. When I joined the police in 1980, I took an oath to protect the country, South Africa. My oath was not to protect the National Party or protect the ANC, but the inhabitants of South Africa. And in this case, exactly when the moment I saw that blue papers and I realized what the meaning of it is and what the potential of it is, I knew that this is something that I must attend on myself. I must do myself, work on it myself, as to protect South Africa as a country.
And I, for one, am incredibly grateful that Tolly took that oath. I always say that one of the biggest shifts that's happened for me over the last 6 years is how I see perpetrators of crime. I'm far more capable of seeing the humanity in even the most cruel of murderers now than I ever was before. I wondered whether Karen, having spent so many years watching these men attend court, grow older, hearing their stories, whether that gave her a glimpse into their humanity.
Absolutely. You could not have described it any better. As I say in the book, when I walked into the courtroom, I immediately, and this was only in hindsight that I realized it, but I immediately judged all of the men in the dock because they represented everything that I did not want to see in my country. And here I needed to spend days with them. And I remember in the beginning, whenever I was deployed to the case again, I would kind of sigh because it was definitely not a trial that I wanted to cover just because I did not enjoy it. But it was once I started to really just observe the men in the dock and you see new family members coming to visit them and the children. And I remember being deeply touched by the aspect of all of the children being involved in this trial. And it's kind of that thing of children having to pay for the sins of their father. And that definitely inspired the writing of the book as well, is for people to see don't judge the children of these men. These men definitely had their own radical ideals. So yes, I definitely couldn't look away from the human aspect, and also like building not relationships, but connections with the men. Like whenever I arrived at court, I would greet them and I would say goodbye. So definitely became a familiar environment after so many years.
Corin would spend quite a lot of time communicating with one particular accused person, Mike Dutoy. And just reading some of what he told her and the way he presented himself to her, I wondered whether she felt that he was trying to manipulate her at all. Or, you know, maybe I'm just far too suspicious for my own good.
So in the beginning, Mike, this was before the sentencing and judgment, so he was allowed to send me emails. And in the emails, he obviously, because when you walk into a trial, into a prison environment, you can't take anything with you. So I was not allowed to take a recording device, much to my frustration. And then eventually they said that I could not take any pen or paper in. So for a journalist, it's quite tough to not have any tools to record anything. And at that stage, he said that he would be able to email me information. And so I would basically leave him with a few questions after visiting him in correctional services, and then he would respond with information. He was never trying to push a narrative. He was actually, I was quite surprised by just how casual he was about sending the information, and he was exceptionally helpful. There were a few things that he had sent of, like articles or essays that he had written from obviously his perspective, but he never forced me to put any of that into the book. So I will always appreciate and respect him for that.
Earlier on, you heard Tolly mention the role that religion and Sina van Rensburg played in this case. I have to admit that I found the cross-section of these two elements very strange. I saw this as a cross-section between what seemed like Christianity and Sina van Rensburg, who, in case you don't know, was a person who a very long time ago made what some believe are predictions about the future, which strongly feature South Africa and often the Afrikaner people. And the reason I found both these things being together odd is because Christianity opposes the idea of people being able to have supernatural powers, such as seeing the future. I asked Tolly about his perception of the intersection of these two elements in this case.
First, address the visions of Sina van Rensburg. And you have to look at the history of Sina himself. He was born in the 1800s and died in 1922. He was a very primitive person, uneducated, and he believed he had the gift to speak to God. Whatever he was discussing is unknown to us because he never wrote it down himself. He told his daughter and she pinned it down. And then 80 years, 90 years later, people like Rand Sneyman came and they wanted to interpret that visions. And that is where it all went wrong. The interpretations that was placed on the visions are so wrong and that is so misleading that it can convince any person that what Sina saw is what fits their narrative. But unfortunately, that is not how it happens. There's another book by Professor Raad and Nelly Swart from the University of Free State, that the vier kleers sal weer wapper, that have a better description of the Sina van Rensburg visions, as well as the more interpretations of each vision. So that is on the Sina van Rensburg visions, but the interpretations of the visions said what the people wanted to hear. If you understand what I'm saying, they wanted to hear that there is a genocide coming to South Africa. They wanted to hear that the Night of the Long Knives will happen when a black leader dies and young boys jumps out of his grave with other guys and start killing the white people. That they call it the Night of the Long Knives. That was never part of his visions. That was just an interpretation of it. Going to the religion, that is completely not a Christianity. The Christian religion, that is Israel vision religion, where they do not acknowledge the existence of Christ, the Son of God. They see him as just also a prophet.
So these men believe that the interpretation of Sina van Rensburg's recorded visions predicted that this racial war, which would end in their victory, would start with the death of a black leader. And so when they planned to assassinate Nelson Mandela, they thought that they would essentially be making that vision a reality. And this would spark, as Tolly says, what they call the Knights of the Long Knives. Karen explains a bit more about the Israel vision belief system.
So Israel vision, when you look at it, it's when you go and search for it on Google, it's not a religion, it's a movement, it's an ideology. And essentially, it's people who think that they are part of the 10 lost tribes of Israel because they believe that these lost tribes somehow ended up as the North European Protestant people. So being descendants from the Afrikaans people in South Africa kind of identify as part of that. But when you look deeper at it, essentially they think that they are the chosen people. They are God's chosen people. They are better than any other race. And when you break that down, that is white supremacy. That is racism. And if that's an ideology that you get up in the morning and that is what you believe, and also for some of the Buramach members, that is how you were raised, that is going to be your reality.
This is not the first time that this Israel vision ideology has been involved in violent terrorist attacks. In 1997, four members of a group who followed this ideology planted a bomb at a supermarket in Worcester. The bomb killed four people and wounded many more. I looked a bit more into that case for my book Killer Stories, where my co-author Dr. Bryn Hodgkiss and I actually feature one of the men who took part in the bombings. Stefan Skutsia has become a friend of mine. He was 17 years old and living in an orphanage when he met the leader of a group that followed the Israel vision ideology. This man took Stefan in and essentially indoctrinated him. Stefan takes full responsibility for what he did, despite having been so young and clearly under coercive influence. He served time in prison, and since his parole, he has built a full life and is an incredibly valuable member of the South African writing community, as well as a great dad and husband. I tell you this because, firstly, I think it's a tragic and important human story, but also because it's vital to understand how this ideology has continued on through the decades and doesn't seem like it's going anywhere. As I mentioned earlier, so much of this felt very cult-like to me.
Just to get back to your original question of can this be seen as a cult, if you look at the David Koresh and the Branch Davidians and the Waco incidents in the U.S., where David Koresh saw himself as a prophet and he saw himself as the Son of God, the Buramach leaders also had the same plan as David Koresh, and they had the same plan as Hitler. And if you go through the testimony of Henk van Sail, where he testified that the Arms Corps building in Pretoria, if you drive up the hill there by Waterkloof, that would have been the center where they kept all the blonde girls with blue eyes. And they will be inseminated by the seeds of the leaders of the Buramach, hence holding their own Aryan, pure Aryan race. That is cult. That is you can equalize that with cultism.
I think that bears repeating for anyone who may think that this group was not that dangerous. The Buramach had a building in Pretoria identified where they were going to keep all the girls with blonde hair and blue eyes. And they were going to inseminate those girls with the sperm of the Buramach leaders to create their own pure Aryan race. And I'm assuming these girls would not be there of their own accord, and their parents would likely have no choice in whether to hand them over or not. Just let that horror sink in for a bit. Because I don't know about you, but if I wasn't already incredibly grateful this group was stopped, I certainly am now. Something that touched me very deeply in reading this book was finding out what Tolly and his family went through while he was working on this case. Besides the ordinary hardships that go along with being a police officer in South Africa, the long days and nights, the time away from your family, and high levels of stress, this case brought along with it more than that. Tolly, his wife, and his children were at real risk of harm, and not just from the members of the Burumakh, but from their own community, who weren't necessarily even involved in the group's activities. Because so many people didn't understand how dangerous and hateful this organization was, or maybe they just didn't care. A large portion of the community Tolly lived within thought that he was doing the wrong thing by chasing down his fellow Afrikaner men. His children had to have special considerations for anything they wanted to do for years. They were bullied by children and teachers, and the Vlechtenberg family became virtual pariahs in their own community. All because Tolly was doing the right thing. As Karen explains in the book, his family were all on board though. His children, as young as they were, understood that their dad was doing something very important, and he was trying to save many lives. I wondered what it was about Tolly, and how he was raised, and how he raised his children, that meant he did not think like so many of his fellow community members.
So I was raised in a police house. My dad was a policeman. And that was the only thing that I wanted to do in my life ever was being a policeman. Very strict, very conservative. My grandparents were of Dutch origin, that hence my surname. But when I joined the police, as I earlier said, my father wanted to, he was a very conservative person. He wanted to give me guidance on certain things, and I not often listened to him. Of course, we had a completely different view of the world. Luckily, when I became a father and my children started growing up, they saw my way of thinking, my way of treating people, and they adapted to it. And even today, two of my children is teachers, and they love it. And one of the most difficult jobs now today is teaching in the schools, but they love it. So yes, my children grew up with circumstances with a guard, armed guard in front of our house for 10 years. They experienced the victimization from their principals, their schools, their co-students, and they just built resistance against it and hence thinking the same way as their father did.
And I think if you take that example of Tolly raising his children with his own values and not necessarily the ideals his father had, that was a positive thing. But the opposite can happen too. And when I was reading about some of these families involved in the Burumakh, and how it was fathers and sons involved, and the mothers were cheering them on from the sidelines, it struck me that these families were almost mini indoctrination systems of their own. They were not just receiving this ideology from the outside once a week at a meeting. They were being indoctrinated from within by their own families too.
Yes, to a certain extent. I mean, if you look at, let's say somebody approached me and said, we have this plan, but they invited me to a meeting of, let's say, the Burumakh, and I listened to what the speakers are saying, with my upbringing, I would start laughing and I would walk away. So I think it heavily depends on the way that you were raised. And as you and Tolly were just saying, it stems from the household. And I mean, I was born at the tail end of apartheid, 89. And so I kind of grew through the era of moving away from racism. But then obviously You've got friends who still use derogatory terms or who don't want to be friends with Black people. And the only reason that's happening is because their parents are telling them that this is the way that we believe it to be. My parents told me we accept everybody, we're inclusive, we're tolerant, everybody's equal. So that is the way that I choose to live my life according to the guidance that I've received. So absolutely, it's if you are susceptible to something, you could definitely fall for these plans.
If you look at the way that the Buruma members were recruited by Mike, his brother Andre and Roy Kwes and later Lawrence du Plessis, they had this false reason for calling, attending a meeting in a rural area. Firstly, the rural areas was picked because farm attacks and the killing of farmers was very prominent during 2001 and 2002. And then during the meeting there, they showed a video of Sine van Rensburg, the Adrian Snyman video of Sine van Rensburg's visions, and where they explained that. And they changed their minds and influenced them and said that danger is coming, but we must prepare ourselves from this possible attack on it. And if, for instance, our investigation showed that they attend a meeting, for instance, at Gardau in the northwest, 50 people joined the meeting or attended the meeting. Only two joined the Buruma afterwards. So the other 48 were not influenced by what they were saying, but two were influenced, and two was enough for them to build on the recruiting push that they had. And then what was interesting, that's where the interesting part comes in of the Israel vision religion, that most of those guys that then say from the 50 were aligned with the Israel vision religion. And that's sense what the base of the whole group was.
I think that's very interesting. So their recruitment numbers were pretty low because the vast majority of people were not convinced by what they were selling. But two was enough. And if those two were part of it, then they might also be able to convince other like-minded people. Also really interesting that they specifically selected rural areas to recruit in and focused on the farm attacks issue as something to pin their ideology to. In my mind, that's classic predator behavior. Find the vulnerability and exploit it. And they did. I feel like a lot of what ended up foiling the Buruma's plans was access to resources. Recently, I read about a case where a man had been caught up in a right-wing organization, and he'd left his estate, which was worth 40 million rand, to the organization when he passed away. Thankfully, his siblings flagged this and ended up going to court to stop the organization from inheriting because they could prove it would be used for illegal training activities. While I was reading about the Buddhamach, though, it just got me thinking, what kind of absolute chaos and loss of life could have been caused by a group like that if they'd had access to 40 million rand?
Yes, they had access to quite a lot of money. If you look at terror financing in the sense of they were self-funded. So one of the early leaders, Lawrence du Plessis, is turned a state witness, Section 204 witness later on the case. He was he's still a very healthy farmer in the Tabazimbi area, but he was not willing to share his money for the cause. He bought false money on the black market and then they used the false notes to fund themselves, and the rest of them were using their pension money, etc. The Pretorius family of Potgieter's Rus, Lech, and his three sons used all their money that they had available to fund the Buruma. And as you said, yes, if they had more access to more money, most probably there will be more success. But I think the biggest problem that they have was access to human resource manpower. The night of the 12th of September 2002, they were gathering here close to Bella Bella on a farm, Kopia Lien, to launch the attack of the 13th of September in Gauteng, where they would have planted 18 car bombs at different places there. They expected 500 people to arrive there. They were preparing for 500 persons to join them. Only 27 pitched up. So that is the willingness of the people also to join them. That was one of the problems.
Call me mean-spirited, but I would have paid to see the look on the face of the Burumakh leaders when their legion of 27 warriors pitched up. And really, this kind of surprised me, to be honest. I guess it just goes to show that what you think seems to be a really widely held ideology, if you look at comments on social media, for instance, just perhaps isn't there in reality. And it's easy to be a keyboard warrior and spew hate online. But when you're actually asked to stand up and do things in real life, very few seem willing to do that, thankfully.
Yes, and if you look at the world history also and the big revolutions that changed the world, the French Revolution was started by Robespierre and a few guys, and it led to the complete change of the landscape of France. If you look at Cuba, there's also five, the two Castro brothers, Che Guevara, and I can never remember that last, the two. They changed the whole face of Cuba. So that can be, we call it a popular uprising, a popular revolution started by a very small group and the rest of the community falling in behind them. But then you get cases where it is completely doesn't happen. It doesn't happen. The community doesn't agree with your visions and your plans, and they do not fall in and join the group.
For both Karen and Tolly, the journey to this book has been long and emotionally draining. I asked Karen how it felt to finally release this book into the world and how it's been received.
So when I held the very first copy of the book in my hands, I was with a friend and she asked me, how does it feel? And I remember just sighing and I almost burst into tears and I said, it feels as if I can breathe. So it's definitely, it's not been something that I've enjoyed. And I'll say that quite honestly, it was more a responsibility than anything else, because I knew that I'd always wished that somebody else was going to write the book. And then I realized that nobody else was going to do it. So to me, it became an absolute responsibility that has really kind of overtaken my life since 2016. So it's been a very, very long time. I'm proud of it. My copy is lying on my desk here with all of my notes. And I'm proud that the Burumakh story can finally be out there for people to finally understand this group and just what motivated them. So, because I don't know whether you've seen this, but so often when you go on social media and there's something about right wingers or a white Afrikaans person, and somebody immediately will refer to the Burumakh and say, oh, but the Burumakh is doing this. And I really just want to quash those ideas. The Burumakh doesn't exist anymore. It was a very specific niche group that no longer exists. So that was part of why I wanted to tell the story. In terms of the reception of the book, it's been, and Tolly can also agree to this, we've received so much feedback from different corners, even from defense teams and accused to themselves, who say that they are happy. It feels like a balanced book to them. And that's all I wanted, was for it to just tell the story objectively.
Nicole, from my side, the story was from the first day in court, I realized this must be a book. There must be a book about this case. I saw the enormity of it. And I'm so glad that Karen, as a younger journalist, took it on her. But the mindset is not the same as Karen. Karen had a more objective mindset and a younger mindset in looking at the facts. And I'm so glad that she's the one. And I'm so proud to be part of her team to put that book on the shelf for the generations to read. Because this is going to be part of South African history in the future.
I wondered how this experience had been for Tolly. I know that when you're working for the SAPS, it's drilled into you to avoid the press and talking publicly like the plague. So I thought it must have been quite a shift for him to now be a public figure talking about this case with Karen in interviews and at launches.
So for me, to say public speaking is not a problem for me. I've been, apart from being a detective for my whole life, I also like to share my experience, and I've trained policemen in South Africa on counterterrorism various hundreds of training sessions. And so public speaking is for me not a problem. Even now, as I'm retired, I just returned from Dar es Salaam, where I'm training East African police on counterterrorism. This is the first time that I can really put my side of the story in the public domain. I was always restricted by the organization that I worked for, that I'm not allowed to speak to the media. Only certain people can speak to the media. But now I have an open platform, and I can tell my side of the story for people to better understand what motivated me and what really happened to me.
And I think that's incredibly important. The public, and I include myself there, need to understand what our police officers are dealing with on a daily basis. I think we need to have those moments, which this book delivers over and again, where we go, holy cow, these guys literally saved our country. And Karen wants to emphasize how deep the effects of this mammoth case really went.
It's also part of the reason for the book is I think people so quickly, they're forced to assume that it was 23 men in the dock and then a judge and a few lawyers. But when you break it down, the 23 accused, all of them had family members. So that already runs into the hundreds. Then you get the detectives, you get the prosecution, you've got the defense, and all of them are also affected by this. It's running into their family time. They're not able to just attend normal family things. So I think it's important for people to realize just how many lives are involved in just in prosecution in general.
The High Treason Club is honestly a must read for every South African. It's a hard-hitting and complex tale of how fear and illogical hatred can be weaponized, and how you will never really know what is happening beneath the visible beating heart of a community until it's too late. It's also a tale of sacrifice and duty, and the men and women who take oaths to protect and serve our country, and take those oaths very seriously. Ultimately, it's a tale of how close we came to losing thousands of South African lives, and how one woman did lose her life. The book is dedicated to Claudia Mokone. And of all the many names in this book, I'm grateful to Karen for ensuring that Claudia's is the first we read. In the end, five of the Burumakh members were found guilty of culpable homicide in relation to Claudia's death. The judge found that the state had not proven a case of murder. One life lost is already too much, but it does not bear thinking to consider how many Claudias there could have been if this group got their way. If ever there was a time when someone's senseless death could teach us anything, I think it's now. And that no ideology or indoctrination or fear or illogical hatred is worth more than human lives. And as far as we may have come in terms of tolerance and equitable thinking, it is not safe to assume that this will never happen again. Because there will always be people who think in the extreme, and who believe that their lives are worth more than others. All we can perhaps hope for is that those individuals will always remain in the very, very small minority, and that there will always be police officers like Tolly Vlechtenberg and journalists like Karen Mitchell to ensure their plans are thwarted. Claudia Mokone, rest gently. If you'd like to hear more victim-focused true crime content, please subscribe to True Crime South Africa on Spotify or the platform you're using to listen right now. If you're looking for something still related to real-life stories, but often with a more positive slant, you can check out my new podcast series, I Live Through This. You can follow both podcasts on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, thank you for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.